Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Gravity Leadership is a growing network of people who believe the center of the Christian life is the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ, and that learning to take love seriously is vital for how we practice discipleship, mission, and leadership. The Gravity Leadership Podcast explores, in practical ways, how to root our lives and our leadership in this love that holds all of us and everything together.
Hey, everybody. Welcome once again to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Ben Sternke. I'm here with my comrades, with my compatriots, with my partners, with my friends. I didn't really think through all of what I was going to call you guys, but
What's our names, Ben?
Yeah, Matt Tebbe is your name.
Say my name.
I'm here with Matt, and I'm also also here with Christy Penley. Hi, Christy.
Merry Christmas, friends.
Merry Christmas to everyone. It is still Advent, but you know we're not going to be too liturgical police on anybody. This is Christmas. It's the week of Christmas.
Oh,
and many of you may already be listening to this, maybe after Christmas.
Yeah, maybe after.
You got a little time off. And you're catching up on your podcast, and you wanted to listen to us interview Kurt Thompson. This was a fantastic interview, by the way.
Yeah.
I can't wait to share this with you.
I wish I could have a podcast with him every week. He's just like, he could be the fourth co-host.
Right. Oh, man. We actually joked about that, having him on just regularly, because he was such a delightful person.
Yeah.
He's a wonderful guy.
We should do a live episode with him on our member platform.
Oh, yeah. That'd be awesome.
Totally. Yes.
Masterclass.
Friends, we'll be talking a lot more about this in the new year, but we're starting a membership where you can get in on these conversations. We'll say more about that in the new year. But Kurt would be an awesome interview. So, before we get into that, Christy sent us some Christmas gifts.
I did.
That she wanted us to open.
Yes.
During this intro.
I hope you have it right there.
I do.
It's all in a stocking so that the little things aren't actually like wrapped. You're just going to pull them out. I tried to put them in order so you guys like open them at the same time.
Okay. Should I grab it and
coordinate here?
Yeah, I think you should, because you're going to have to describe to our listeners what I sent.
I know. If there was a video.
I know. Too bad it's not.
You'll be able to see this lovely stocking. It's a lovely red and green stocking.
All right.
Yeah. There we go. So okay. Well, at the first.
Wait. Do we have to open the card first? That's what was a rule of my family.
No. You know what? Give the card. Yeah, I know it is. Give the card to your wives.
Okay.
All right. I'll give the card away. Okay. A candy cane.
First thing.
Look at this candy cane.
A candy cane. Look at that. Just great. Merry Christmas.
What is this?
Okay. So the first thing in my stocking is a hat.
Oh yeah. Put that sucker on.
It's got
the Colorado flag on. And so, I mean, I'm in Colorado. You guys are in Indiana, but you need some Colorado gear.
Yeah. All right.
This hat is really fancy, but it's super tight on my head. It's super like.
It's the flat brim. Listen, my boys are all about flat brims. So. Yeah.
I know. You know. Because your kids are dope. Sorry, all right. What else in here?
Hold on. I got to get my hat on.
Oh, I cannot wait.
Christy Finley.
Oh, yeah. Tell us what it is.
All right. Christy Finley sent me a Ziploc baggie. There's a Ziploc baggie here. Look at that. Oh, there's something in the Ziploc baggie. Oh, these are those little, what do they call these?
Flossers.
Dental flossers.
Dental picks.
Yeah. Okay. Some of our listeners are going to remember. But at one point, y'all were like, we need these everywhere. We need them in our car and at our desk. And look at Ben's using it right now, you guys. Yep. Hilarious.
This isn't like a secret. Christy has to put up with this. Like, we straight up like dental floss our teeth while we're recording podcasts. And she's kind of like
toenails.
It's gross to me.
No,
just
kidding. We don't do that. We don't pick our teeth.
Yeah, but you did one time.
Intro.
You did one time have a piece of dental floss like on your desk. Yeah. It was just sitting there.
Right. Yep. We talked about
and
that.
And you were
in
like,
intro.
It's clean. And I'm like, that's gross. Like, it shouldn't be. Just... Okay. Well, find what else? Because there's also another dental thing in there. Like, if you can find
your hat back on.
Little box.
I got my hat. Fixed my hat. Oh. This is a whoopee cushion. Wait, is this guy giving? Okay,
blow mine up.
This is awesome.
Okay, listen.
Whoopee cushion.
I gave him a whoopee cushion because sometimes y'all totally blowing it up. Sometimes y'all
blow mine up. What's going on?
Listen, I have to work with you too.
Yeah, right.
Chrissy, I just have one thing to say.
What is it?
So violent.
Oh my word. I shouldn't have sent it. No, oh,
that's
my goodness.
Great. That's perfect.
You know.
Well, you were going to say, what's the reason you sent us whoopee cushion?
Oh, just because like, you know, working with two boys, I feel like sometimes, you know.
Boys.
Sorry, I'm 46. Said boys.
Yeah, we are boys.
Well, but you like really whoopee cushions, so.
Sure. Really accurate.
Okay. All right. What else is in your stocking?
What else we got?
There is another dental thing.
One more.
Oh, dental floss.
There's dental.
Did you get some floss?
And then
I just figured, you know. But then the last thing.
Colorado socks, Bernies.
I've just heard about Bernies.
Yes,
Bernies? They're the best. They're great like for skiing and sledding and being outside, all things cold. Yeah, and I thought you needed a pair.
This is great.
This is amazing, Christy.
I am Merry decked Christmas, out y'all. Now. Christy, you're the best.
Now you look like you're from Colorado.
I was actually just talking.
Because everybody from Colorado just wears Colorado swag all the time. Oh, this is great. Yeah. Oh,
probably more people from Colorado wear Colorado swag than people from Indiana wear Indiana swag.
That's true.
Right?
Is there anything such thing as Indiana swag? Do you have any?
I mean, it's mostly focused on the...
Like a team.
Yeah, it's mostly focused on if a college team or pro team. It's Colts
Colorado
stuff.
Colorado just likes
Purdue
its people. We don't need a team.
IU stuff.
We have pride in ourselves. This is great, Christy. Thank you so much. Awesome.
Merry Christmas, y'all.
I'm gonna see Ben a little later today. I'm gonna wear some Colorado socks and a Colorado hat.
And you might bring your whoopee cushion.
If I wear my Colorado hat, I think people might look at us funny.
Twinning.
I know they're this. They're the same. That's funny.
There is there is a couple that lives in a neighborhood that some folks from our church live in, and this couple dresses identically every single day.
For real?
Yeah, for real. Like the
How
first time I
they?
Saw them, I don't.
Are they in
like
their 80s?
Millennials? They're like millennials.
Oh.
And the first time I saw them, I was like, "What? Like, what's going on over there?" And they're like, "Oh, they do that every day." Like every single day, they dress the same and they go for like long walks around the neighborhood. So they're like totally unironically dressing identically.
You know how I picture when you say that? I picture Todd and Margot from Christmas Vacation. Remember that couple that lives next to Clark Griswold?
Very vaguely. I can't remember that.
That was Julia Marie Dreyfus. Louise, not Marie.
Oh.
Louise Dreyfus.
Oh, yeah.
Remember her?
Yeah. Back in the day. I did.
Christy, don't even have to ask. I know that these are gifts from the heart. These are gifts from the heart from Christy to us, and they mean a great deal. So thank you so much.
Yeah. Oh, man. You're welcome. It's fun.
Yeah. You're really good at this gift buying thing. I was just telling somebody the other day that I want to get better at gift buying or at least like gifting things to people. I don't I'm not very good at it. So,
well, let me just out of help. Have y'all bought your wives a gift?
Yeah. I mean, for Christmas,
you got your
Christmas.
Yeah. You're good.
I never have bought my wife a gift. No, Christmas is good.
We're covered. Matt, did you buy Sharon a gift yet?
No. But I'm thinking about giving her a whoopee cushion now.
No, that is
bag
not
of flossers.
No. I'm taking my kids.
You cannot re-gift anything I just gave you for your wife.
I'm thinking, honey, how are your teeth doing? I'm taking my kids Christmas shopping this evening. And my wife has a girls' night. They're going to watch a movie. Okay. And we're going to go Christmas shopping for Sharon this evening. But Christy, I have no idea what to get her.
Nothing that plugs in. Let me just tell you that. Don't buy her something that plugs in.
Okay.
Like nothing that, like, you can't buy her a blender or hair dryer or something like that.
I did see a commercial about something called Toyotathon. And apparently people are buying their spouses $40,000 cars without telling them about it first.
No.
Mm.
No. All right. Gift cards are good. Find your favorite store.
A week-long Christian festival, Toyotathon.
All right,
I saw that joke on the internet the other day.
All right, I'll think about it. If you, you know Sharon a little bit, Christy.
Yes, I love Sharon.
Cece, my 9-year-old, is a gift buying guru. She loves buying gifts, loves wrapping gifts, loves getting gifts. So I'll let her help me pick out a present for her mom.
Okay, well, good.
We'll be good. Thanks so much, Christy, for
this
care
package.
You got a
couple more days. Oh, yeah.
And this stocking.
Yeah, this is so fun. Let's do this every week. Just kidding.
The 12 days of Christmas. Here we go.
12 days of Christmas, yeah. 12 weeks of podcast.
All right, well, should we jump? All right. People clicked on this hoping to get Kirk Thompson, and we're just talking about.
And they got Christmas, but they also hope for some Christmas cheer.
The podcast itself is a gift. It really is good.
It is.
And
it's really
I really
good.
Like him a lot. I've read his books. Mm-hmm. I'm using some of his stuff from his books in my research for my actual degree. Mm-hmm. And so, but you know what's better than even his books is him as a person.
Yeah.
And it's, he's just a delight and I really respect him a lot. So I enjoyed our time together.
Yeah, I did too. This new book is really good. It's called The Soul of Desire. And Kurt Thompson wrote a lot about shame and has taught me a lot about shame. But this book on desire really resonates well with, if you know anything about Gravity Leadership Academy, we focus a lot on getting in touch with desire. It's a really important aspect of what it means to be a spiritual leader, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so Kurt seems to get this intuitively and he writes really, really well about it. And like you were saying, Christy, whenever I meet somebody that I like as an author, I'm always a little bit nervous to actually meet them for a podcast interview or in real life, because you just never know. You just never know.
Hmm.
But delightfully, Kurt is, he's just the real deal. And so he's a lovely person. He's a real Christian, if you know what I mean. So
I like those phonies.
Yeah, those phony Christians. he's great. And this interview was a lot of fun and I learned a lot. So
let's get into it.
All right. Let's get into it, friends. We should probably blurb. We need to, if you're not part of our email list, we always forget to do this, guys. We have too much fun. But if you're not part of our email list, please join us, gravityleadership.com/join. You get a free email from us. It's free. You don't even have to pay for the email.
A Merry Christmas email.
A Merry Christmas email every Friday. But go ahead and sign up for that. And then, as we said before, we're going to share more about this membership platform in the new year that we're looking to release and start to populate. So let us get into Kurt Thompson. Amen.
Here we go.
All right.
All right. All right, everyone. Our guest on the podcast today is Kurt Thompson. Kurt is a board-certified psychiatrist and the founder of Being Known, an organization that develops resources for hope and healing at the intersection of neuroscience and Christian spiritual formation. He's the author of The Soul of Shame and The Anatomy of the Soul and the book that we're talking about today, which is called The Soul of Desire. Kurt, welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast.
Ben, thank you. And to Christy and Matt, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, we are excited to talk with you today. Is there anything else that you would like for us to know about you before we dive in?
Like all these things are getting shaped by the three probably most formative relationships for me, which include my wife of 35 years and my two adult kids. And that's I think that's important for folks to know. And I tell this book to folks regularly, like that I'm a professional sinner. I'm not. Nice. I don't mess around.
Yeah.
And like I'm really glad that there are only 10 commandments.
Yeah.
Because if there were that way, I only have to keep track of that many that I break every day. Not more than that.
It's helpful.
But I'm not really being tongue in cheek. There is a sense in which it's always great to be having conversations with people who recognize that it's that in following the King, it's something that's really just not easy to do.
Yeah.
And as we say, the brain can do a lot of hard things for a really long time, as long as it doesn't have to do it by itself. And so I'm glad to be doing that work with you all today.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Kurt. I'm glad for that as well.
Yeah.
So we're talking about your work has actually been really helpful for me personally and for Gravity for several years, the other books that I mentioned. But this book that we're talking about today, The Soul of Desire, is a really, really good book. I was just commenting to you, Kurt, before we hit record, that this is there's a lot of wisdom, creativity. This is a gentle book, and it's a funny book. And so I'm actually going to be adding this. It really coheres nicely with a lot of the work that we do in Gravity Leadership Academy around desire and helping people see how Jesus did this with people, asking questions. The question that frames the book, you know, what do you want, is a key question in our training. And so this is going to become part of our kind of supplemental reading that we show to people as they go through our leadership training. And so anyway, I just wanted to say thanks for writing this book, Kurt. Wow. It's a really great book.
Well, your words are very kind, and thank you for saying them, and I will be taking them in for some time to come. Thank you.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, talk to us about the genesis of this book. What were you seeing or sensing that made you want to address the question of desire?
Well, I think it came, you know, that as we were talking a little bit before we started the recording, there was kind of an emergence out of the fog of this idea of desire. The previous two books that I've written, the first one I wrote primarily what began with a demographic of my patients in mind. There were certain things that we were going to apply, this neuroscience and Christian spiritual formation, that would seem pretty plain. And out of that grew the second book, because we really wanted to focus on shame. And out of this book on shame, there was this kind of amorphous sense that there's something more to be said in response to this notion. What does it mean for us to be in our cloud of witnesses, and what do we then go on to do? A number of years ago, I had the privilege of spending a week collaborating with Mako Fujimura around this question of what does it mean for us to be artists in the world? What do artists become? And what is it like for us to imagine ourselves as bearing God's image as artists in the world, as God being an artist? And one of the things that began to strike me in that week that we were spending time together, as he painted and I and others talked about the work that we do, it began to strike me that the work that we do, even in working with patients, is not, I mean, it's easy for us to think about this in terms of fixing problems, diagnosing pathologies and treating pathologies. But really, what really began to emerge for me there was this notion that actually what we are doing is we are trying to create beauty and goodness in the world. We're not just trying to fix problems. We're not just trying to identify the world as a problem, but we're really trying to imagine the world as an artistic expression that is in the process of emerging. This is what new creation is really all about. It's about redoing, regenerating what Genesis 1 and 2 point us toward in the first place. And out of that grew this notion that more so than even beyond this notion of community being an answer to shame and to its destructive effects, beyond that, is this notion that an even fuller answer to this is that we are called to create beauty in the very place where trauma and shame have been. We don't just want to fix it. We don't just want to go back to baseline, but that we want to see this as an opportunity for creativity.
Yeah.
And of course, this is pretty counterintuitive for us as human beings, let alone the patients that walk into our office. And we ask the question now, in the last several years, we've been practicing asking patients the question, what is the next new artifact of beauty in your life that you long to create? Of course, if you're depressed or anxious, or you're like, you know, in a marriage that is failing, you're like, I don't get it. Like, what's this got to do with anything?
Right.
I think in the similar way that perhaps Jesus' disciples or John's disciples might have been caught off guard a little bit when Jesus inquires of them in 1 John 1:38, this notion of what do you want?
Yeah.
Which is an utterly stunning and startling question when you think about what would have been going on in a first century time frame, let alone what it's like for us even now to imagine we can ask each other what we want. It's, you know, it's Christmas. I got my Christmas stuff on here. Like, we can ask each other, what do we want? But even when we ask each other, it makes me nervous. Do I have the right answer to the question? Am I going to answer something that's going to get me in trouble? Perhaps I don't even know. Like, I legitimately don't know, because perhaps desire for me as a person has been too intertwined with my trauma.
Yeah.
And because of that, I work really, really hard not to allow myself to want things, because it's just too dangerous.
Yeah.
And so this notion then began to have me being curious about what does it mean for us to be people of desire, because we express things. And then it turns out you start to look at this and, my goodness, from the very beginning, you're like, this is what kids do. Kids create. They long to be known, but they long to be known in order to make stuff. They want to make stuff in the world, and you don't have to teach them to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They just come out of the, you know, they just come out making things. And this doesn't ever stop unless we put an end to it, which we often do, because we start to associate longing for creativity with, I'm going to get into trouble, I'm not going to do this right enough, so forth and so on. And so between this, you know, in this intersection with the work that Mako and I were doing, along with, I think, just developmental realities and interpersonal neurobiological, like, emergence of things as kids develop, and then really seeing that the entire arc of the biblical narrative is about preparing us to do when the fullness of the new heaven and earth arrives, to helping us practice for what's coming. This whole notion of what Lewis would say is further up and further in, that every day, Paul's language in Colossians, this notion that even though the old nature is wasting away, the new inner nature is being renewed every day, which is weird, right? It's not just made new, like I got a new car and it's new and it's only new once and then it's old thereafter.
Right.
Like, today I'm new, tomorrow I'm newer, the next day I'm newer. Like, that doesn't really, I don't really quite get that with my time, you know, how I time travel.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm perhaps off topic now, but that's the long-winded answer to your question.
No, this is great. This is great. You're touching on so much that I want to talk about here, Kurt.
This podcast is brought to you by Gravity Leadership Academy, our 10-month online training intensive for Christian leaders who want to root their life and leadership in God's love and bring lasting transformation to their culture. In Gravity Leadership Academy, you'll learn the real-life practicalities of how to notice God's presence and activity in and around you, so you can participate more fully in God's life and mission, and open up space for those around you to do so too. We've worked really hard to make this training in missional leadership practical and doable. To find out more about Gravity Leadership Academy, visit gravityleadership.com/academy.
You talk about Jesus' question of what do you want being this startling question. And you write in the first part of this book that it's a life-altering practice to answer this question consistently. And I wonder if you could just tease that out for us. Like, why is Jesus so interested in us getting in touch with our desire? Maybe you can draw a little bit clearer connection between desire and beauty and goodness. Like, how are those things, you know, connected? And then what's so transformative about this practice of naming what we want?
Recognizing that we have 30 to 40 minutes and not several days.
This is a masterclass.
I think one thing it's helpful to remember is that the Gospel of John is often seen as a recapitulation of Genesis. Mm-hmm. And we see so much of what John writes as being is done so with the light of Genesis shining in the room. Mm. And when he writes about when Jesus asks this question, in many respects, this is the very act of God in the first two chapters of Genesis. This whole notion of God wanting to make us, one would think that if you get to the end of Genesis chapter one, that when it comes to making humans, that God would do the same, that the writer would give us the same story that he would give with everything else. And God said, let there be human beings, and there were human beings. But it doesn't say that. It says, and God said, let us make mankind in our image. There's a whole conversation about it. There's a pause. There's a reflection. There is this, as you know, they're brilliant. The Genesis writers are brilliant in the sense that they don't explain everything. They don't tell everything. They show us. They just show us. And they're showing us a God of desire, a God who wants to make human beings. And if we are to presume that this is the God who can see down the road all the way to Good Friday, we see that this is a God who wants us even in the face of what we will do to him. Mm-hmm. But we also see this God as a wanting God, connecting this desire. So when we are made in his image, we are necessarily made as people who reflect a God who is the great desirer. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be people of desire. And if we're going to be in his image, then if we notice how God desires things, this notion that when you read the first portion of Genesis 1, this notion that, and God saw that it was good, all those things that God made, there will be this line in many of those verses, and God saw that it was good. The word good in Hebrew can easily be interchanged for the word beautiful. Mm. And God saw that it was beautiful. But it's not just a matter of God seeing something as being beautiful. I'm God, there's the object over there. There is this sense in which the beauty of that which God sees emerges as a function of God looking at it. And so we recognize that if all of this is happening, then it's my goodness. We aren't just called to create beauty because we are imaging the one who's made us to operate like he operates. We are actually, in so doing, God is seeing us and we are emerging as beauty as we do this. And this, of course, is a really big deal, because how many of us, you know, if I were to just take 5 minutes, and this would be really uncomfortable, I just because we've done this to patients in our offices, and like, I'll tell you, like, they tell us it's uncomfortable. We have this. I'll just say it. So we have this exercise in which we'll take a married couple, of course, that are like, they're maybe mad at each other, whatever. We'll give them this. The exercise is, I want you to sit knee to knee, just looking at each other for the next 5 minutes. I just want you to look each other with loving kindness. You're not staring. You're not batting. You're looking at each other, loving kindness. And of course, the first 90 seconds are just hell. Mm. Because the whole notion of, like, when's the last time that anybody has looked at you for longer than like 5 or 6 seconds, let alone for 5 minutes. And of course, once they get past this whole notion and they're working to look at one another with loving kindness, you'll watch the distress kind of playing out, and then they will get comfortable with each other. And then you will notice by the time the 5 minutes are up, they don't want to stop. Wow. Because they are looking at each other with loving kindness, and it is in that gaze that beauty emerges. They don't even have to say to each other, beauty is what I see. Beauty is being called forth out of each of them because of the gaze by which they're captured. Mm. And I want to invite us to consider that this is what God is doing with his creation. This is what God is doing with us, and this is what God has called us to do in the work that we do as leaders. This is what we are called to do. We are called to gaze upon that which we are working with and call forth its beauty.
Wow.
There you go. I think that's trying to answer the question.
Yeah.
That is powerful. It's really powerful. Mm-hmm. And it makes me think of so much in the church. We start with Genesis 3. We start, I'm a sinner.
Right. Right.
And not in Genesis 1 and 2 that I'm beloved, right. that I'm seen, that I'm
right.
desired, that I'm
right.
I'm curious to hear from you, if you would be willing to share, how did writing that part of the book, of unearthing that in your own personal life transform you? Because that's not just something we say. That like that goes from our head knowledge to the bones of who we are.
Right. And you're absolutely right. And the thing is that, of course, you know, that little exercise that I just shared, you know, we pretty quickly reveal to people that we don't practice this very much. We're made very quickly, very uncomfortable with the notion of someone being that intimately, you know, like it feels intrusive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it feels intrusive because that kind of a gaze is necessarily touching the parts of us that we feel most worried about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're going to see the part of me that when you do, you're going to go mm-hmm. and you're going to go tell all your friends, mm-hmm. don't ever look at Kurt again. And so not only part of why we begin at Genesis 3 is because beginning at Genesis 1 and 2 is so terrifying.
Yeah.
And so, for me personally, I mean, I could spend a month of Sundays just like in my marriage, for instance. You know, my wife will tell me that we'll have one of these moments where, you know, Kurt does what he's been doing for 35 years.
The professional somehow, sinner stuff.
You know, exactly. I mean, like for the love of Pete, like why? There are just certain patterns, mm-hmm. right? That like you just, you know, continue to maintain. And when something like this, if there's a rupture that I'm responsible for, I don't just feel bad because it's happened. I feel bad because it's one piece of evidence that like this is not ever going to change. Yeah. So it's like shame layered upon shame and so forth. And when this happens, at least in our marriage, it's very easy for me to go to this place where I can't imagine that she wants to have anything to do with me. Mm-hmm. And then, and of course, this is not true for her.
Right.
And then when we come back, she said, like, it's almost as if you were to imagine our marriage being this, if you were to look at like a circle in our marriage is like looking under the microscope at the entire circle, what's under the lens. And it's this very bright light. And up in one, there's just one on the rim of the edge of the microscope of the viewfinder. There's this speck that represents this part of our marriage. Hmm. And when this happens, it's as if you take the lens and you drop the lens over the speck, and the speck fills the entire field. Mm-hmm. And like, that's all you see. I'm like, yeah, this is because it, like, I can't imagine you continuing to look at me. And she would say, so then we need to practice. You need to practice with me looking at you in this space. And I can't make you pull your lens up. I can't make you do that. But that's just one example. Mm. And like this is, you know, as I say, you know, you write books and then you're like, crap, why did I write that? Because now I got to work through the stuff I just wrote and it's going to take me forever to do this,
which has
been part and parcel of this. I mean, I have any number of places in terms of, you know, speaking of leadership, I sold my practice to the person who I worked very closely with a couple of years ago, turned that over. And the very moment that I did, I was sure that like I was going to be the least interesting thing in the practice, like, you know, next to the tax returns and to have to work through what it now means to not have the title and the position and so forth and so on, to think that, that sense that people want you in the room, that people want to gaze upon you when you are so well aware of all the things about you that you can't imagine that they would ever want to have in the room.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, Christy, if this is answering your question, but I think it has been enlightening and also like, because of, there is this, unveiling of parts of me that I now have to work on. And I would say now after a few months of this, I'm grateful for that. But I would say I wasn't grateful for it like 2 years ago.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Kurt, I wonder if I love this connection between desire and beauty and goodness. But I think a lot of people, when they hear like getting in touch with your desires, they don't think about, oh yeah, I really want to create something beautiful. And I really like, they think about bad things, right? They think about, oh, desire is what led to my affair, or desire is what makes me drink too much on the weekend, or, you know, desire is like they associate their desire with this thing that's going to lead them astray. Like if I follow my desires,
it's a crouching lion waiting to devour us.
It's and you know, and the scriptures talk about this a little bit, the church fathers, you know. So how would you respond to that? How would you help someone delineate, you know, who's scared of getting in touch with their desires because they're afraid they're going to, like, you know, fall off a cliff?
Right. Well, I would say a couple of things. One is I would go back to and reference what Christy, what you said just a moment ago, that we begin in Genesis 3. That's where we begin. And in some respects, beginning in Genesis 3 is safer. Because as long as I can know that, oh, desire is bad, I'm not going to go there. I don't have to mess around with it. The problem is it doesn't keep the desire from being active. Yes. It is going to have its day in court with me. And it's either going to lead to behaviors that kind of fly under the radar of our common concepts of what are bad behavior. Like I'm just going to eat a half sleeve of Oreos every night, or I'm going to not indulge in pornography, but I'm going to get pretty close to it in terms of what's going on in the privacy of my own mind, or I'm going to work myself to death, or all the things. All the soft addictions that we come up with, that will be one thing that I would, and this is the thing that trauma and shame tend to do. They don't just shatter my connection relationally with others. They also shatter my capacity to appropriately perceive the nature of what has happened, which means I'm not aware that I still actually have desire. I'm just going to put a lid on it. That's what I'm going to do. And I'm going to have these, which is really what, you know, our kind of, this is what Pharisees were really doing, right? This is the part of me that is Pharisaical will do. I'm going to put a lid on this. These are the rules. As long as I obey the rules, I don't like step outside the lines. I don't get into trouble, but my desire is going to do something. It's going to find a way to get out. And so two things I would say is that it's really crucially important for us from a teaching standpoint and to invite people into a space where they can imagine, what does Genesis 1 and 2 tell us? This is why the preaching of the gospel, this is why our spiritual formation, this is why our catechesis, this is why the things of the church need to begin in the beginning.
Yeah.
Now, we also need to then include what happens in Genesis 3, not just to remind us that we're all sinners. I got it.
Right.
But to remind us that our brokenness also shatters our capacity to understand what the nature of the way forward is.
Yeah.
And the nature of the way forward is not to put a lid on my desire, but to actually explore it to its end. Explore it comprehensively. Yes. Jesus asks this question in John 1:38 primarily as a way to begin the conversation that of course is going to end with, well, I guess what it is that we want is you.
Yeah.
And we want to be seen, soothed, safe, made to be secure by you. We want this in order for us to create beauty and goodness. Yeah. And along the way, I have to acknowledge how trauma and shame in my life and generationally in my parents, my grandparents, and all that they've given me tends to take me in a direction in which desire does get transformed into devouring. I can't pretend that doesn't happen. Yeah. This is evil's, I mean, this is what evil's about. Evil's about devouring us. And as long as he can get us to devour ourselves and each other, that's much less work that he has to do.
Yeah.
And so, to the degree that we are naming desire, but also acknowledging trauma, when we are entering into that trauma and shame with others, it is in those moments and those memories that they're given the opportunity to really recall what was the desire that was going on in the moment that happened. Yeah. What was that really about? Was that really about having an affair?
Right.
Is that really what you wanted? was the gossip really what you wanted to do? Was the rage in your kitchen? Is that really what you wanted to be? What was that really about? What did you want? Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted her to fill in the blank. And how would that have been helpful for you? And when was the first time you felt that kind of anger? Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it was when I was 6. Oh. And what was happening then? What did you want when you were 6 or 15 from your father or from your mother? Mm-hmm. That you now think you wish you could get it from your wife. And even though it's your wife that you wish you could get it from, it's really your dad and your mom that you've been waiting for 40 years to get it. And so no wonder the rage is so great, because like there's a big tank of it, because mm-hmm. it didn't begin 10 years ago in your marriage. Mm-hmm. You've been collecting this rage for a long yeah. time. And you haven't had somebody who can enter into this to invite you to name what it was that you wanted when you were 6. Yeah. And when you were 20. And if you can't name that desire, well, of course, it's going to get wrapped up in all kinds of other devouring practices. Mm-hmm. And then you just start to literally, neurally, we splice together my trauma and my shame with my desire. Yes.
Right. So we can't tell.
And I learned very quickly, right. And I learned very quickly, like, that's just really bad karma. So I'm not going there.
Well, this is a masterclass and a therapy session now. Sounds like this is great.
Yeah, Ben, if you lean much closer to your video camera, I'll lean closer to my video camera. And let's just have 6 minutes of silence here.
Yeah, yeah.
You okay. and me, buddy.
Listeners, well, you're well, turning up the volume.
Kurt, I...
We'll look at each other.
I have look at each other.
Loving kindness.
You are... I feel like you're doing some detangling work for us, and I want to see if I'm catching it. And I want to hold it back before us just to see if I'm with you. In your previous work, The Soul of Shame, you talked a lot about shame, and you keep referencing it here as it relates to desire mm-hmm. and trauma. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm aware of as you're speaking is how we often try to use shame to master desire or to control mm-hmm. it, mm-hmm. right? And right. I think, for instance, for like a short period of time, shame is sufficient to not act on desire. So, you know, I'm not going to cheat on my wife in front of my wife because that would be too embarrassing. But eventually, mm-hmm. what you're mm-hmm. talking about is that desire, if it's not explored all the way through, it will take dominion and win. Mm-hmm. I guess my question here is... What is the role of, you describe goodness and beauty, and I want to maybe introduce the word love. Like, what is the role of love as a centering, orienting, arranging experience in the human Christian life as it pertains to desire and shame? Like, how does that all get resolved? How does that unwind and become whole?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, again, try not to take up too much time. I think, you know, one thing that we tell people is, you know, we use words as humans as symbols of things that are both before and beyond words. So for instance, when we talk about, when we use the word mm-hmm. love, I like to say, like, look, there's no such thing as love. In and of itself, right? Paul writes about it in 1 Corinthians 13, of course, but it's metaphor, right? Love really amounts to loving acts. Mm. Like, it's not like there's the four of us, five of us, and love that are in the room. It's not like it's a thing that's in the room. I only know that it's in the room when I sense you looking at me with loving kindness. Mm. It's a loving act. Mm. I sense love with you if you're my dad and you are looking at me with loving kindness while you are also saying no to me about the thing that I want to do. Like, now I don't, like, I'm, you know, I'm 10 years old and you're saying no, but you're doing it with loving kindness. And like, there's a part of me that like doesn't like this. Like, I don't like this doesn't feel loving kindness. Mm-hmm. But that in fact is a loving act. But now the definition is broadening, like the experience is broadening. Mm-hmm. You're helping me, what we would say in the business is, you're helping me expand my window of tolerance, mm-hmm. which is a neurophysiologic effect of learning how to live with and regulate uncomfortable emotional states while remaining connected to another human being. Hmm. And this connection is really the key. This is the reason why God's know, right? Planting the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the center of the garden, not 40 miles to the west under a bunch of brambles where they could never find it, but putting it right in the middle of things, why his know is such, it is as important a function of his loving them as was his yes. You have the entire garden with one exception. And the one exception was as much a part of his love as was the entire rest of the garden. Mm-hmm. And so when we say love here, beauty, goodness, we're using it as a word that encompasses lots of these different embodied, perceived acts that we both commit, that you and I commit, and that you and I receive from each other. And we would say that, you know, we could measure these things neurophysiologically, but we would say that what this ends up looking like in the real world are people, you and me and our kids and our parents, you and me, who behave with greater states, more frequent and deeper states of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. All those are also words that describe various particular ways that we experience the world. Mm. When I'm having to work at being patient, that feels different than when I'm being joyful. And when I'm being faithful, but those are words, but that it's a broad range of interpersonal and neurobiologic experience, yes, in which we are being more and more and more like the King.
Yeah. Are you saying then that love too often, we're too often comfortable making love sort of an abstract conceptual truth, when in reality, mm-hmm, love is a relational, existential, embodied act? Like, love, right, is a happening, I mean, not an abstract concept.
Right. I mean, an ancient Hebrew might be kind of confused with the way that we talk about the things we talk about. Since Descartes and the separation of the things that I think of from the embodied material universe, it's become very fashionable for us to talk about all these things as if they actually exist in their abstract forms. Mm.
Yes.
When in fact, none of it exists in its abstract form. It only exists in terms of what you and I are doing with and toward each other in any given moment. We got to talk about them in the abstract as a way to have a way to talk about them, but that's not their primary way of existing. I can only do this when real things are happening, which is why when it gets then to, you know, preaching the gospel, for instance, we've kind of taken on Descartes' fashion of, like, we preach the gospel as if it's this. Now, we don't think explicitly in these terms. We don't come out and say this is an abstract. No, we believe it's a real thing, but we talk about it as if it's abstract.
Yeah.
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 Instead of recognizing that the brain actually doesn't work that way at all. The brain operates most durably. We take in, we ingest, digest, and metabolize things most effectively, bottom to top and right to left. First, I sense, and only then do I make sense of what I sense.
Yep. Man, this is so good. As we draw this to a close, Kurt, I wonder if you could take a lot of what you've been talking about here, that these embodied acts that are so important for us to kind of untangle. And I really appreciate what you're sharing about desire, that, like, that underneath, we can almost, it's almost like you're saying, under, like, we can trust that underneath our worst desires, so to speak, there is a godly desire. There is a desire that's placed there, you know, that underneath the things that I want that are bad for me is something that I actually want that would fulfill me, right? We actually want it to be, you know, seen as significant. We actually want to belong to one another. We actually want to see beauty and goodness.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
So anyway, my question was this. You talk in the book about gathering people into confessional communities. And, you know, a lot of the coaching we do, so Gravity Leadership Academy is a group environment where we're, you know, talking with one another. And sometimes people wonder about that, because coaching sometimes is seen as like a, you know, a one-on-one thing. But I think some of what you describe that happens in confessional communities, I think is part of the goodness that happens in our groups. as well. And
I
wonder,
I'm not surprised. Yeah,
so I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit more about that. Like what's the vital role of community and confession in sort of unwinding our shame and our trauma and helping us get in touch with desire?
Yeah. Well, one thing I'll point out, this question comes to me sometimes about like, well, gosh, these, you talk about these confessional communities, they sound so other. They sound so like artificial. They, like, these aren't the kinds of things that would just develop organically. Like, you got to have two therapists and you got to pay money and you got all these rules and all these things you got to do. This feels very synthetic. Doesn't feel like this would, it wouldn't just like happen on my front porch. Right. To which I say, as it turns out, somewhat surprisingly, there is nothing that we do in confessional communities that we don't do in every other single domain of life that we occupy, whether it's in your family, your church, your school, in the checkout line at Safeway. It doesn't matter. Any interaction contains all the things that we do in these confessional communities, with two exceptions. And the exceptions are, number one, the degree of conscious intentionality we are bringing to the interaction of the relationship at any given moment. How purposefully am I going to be in relationship with you? I get to Safeway, I'm going through the checkout line, I just want to get home. Everything is on autopilot. I'm not paying attention to the clerk. I'm not paying attention. They're not, but what happens if I do? Suddenly, we have our own little confessional community going on. Now, you know, she might not talk about her marriage because she's got to get my groceries through the line, or I might. But we can talk about things that we otherwise don't typically talk about, even just by noticing things, even by just thanking people for what they've done. So, number one, the degree of intentionality with which we are purposefully being in relationship with the person, number one. And number two, the degree to which we are aware of the process of the relationship that's taking place. Mm. How aware am I of what's actually going on? When the person cuts me off in traffic, I'm like, I'm so pissed off because I'm trying to get to work, all the things, right? Mm-hmm. And my autopilot brain just takes over. As opposed to, and the question that I would ask is like, what's wrong with him? What's wrong with her? As opposed to, oh, I'm aware that I'm feeling things. I'm like, oh my gosh, like what happened to them? That's a different question. Yeah. But that is about being aware are the layers of what's happening in the moment, in the relationship at any given time. What we do in the confessional community, and we call them this not because we're confessing sin, but because to confess is to tell the truth about one's life. We believe that our mission is to tell our stories more truly. Leadership, for example, I would say a way to think about leadership is that if I am a leader, if I'm in a position of leader, if I occupy an office of that, my role is really to enable the people with whom I interact intimately, for whom I have responsibility, I want to enable them to tell their story as truly as possible.
Yes.
I want to do whatever I can do to enable them to flourish, enable them to create beauty and goodness in the world, to do those works that were foreordained before the foundation of the world for them to do. I want to call forth beauty in them in the way that God called forth beauty in Genesis 1. Mm. Yeah. But I can't do that as a leader for them if someone else is not doing the same thing for me. Because I cannot give anybody what I don't have. This is why Trinitarian theology is such a big freaking deal.
Totally.
And perhaps we can talk about that more at another time. But
a little teaser for our next podcast with you, Kurt. Yeah. I would love to do this with you every month. Deal? Just once a month you're on our podcast. Great.
Call Jody.
Yeah, we'll figure it out.
She's my gatekeeper.
No, I'm joking, but it was great to have you, Kurt, and there's so many threads that I want to chase down and talk about. And so I do want to have you on another time. And maybe we can figure out a way for you to continue to just teach us and talk to our community.
It would be a delight.
It's really, really good. Yeah. Friends, the book is called The Soul of Desire, Discovering the Neuroscience of Longing, Beauty, and Community. And it's really good. And it's going in our supplemental material for Gravity Leadership Academy. Mm-hmm. Kurt, how else can people reach out and get in touch with you or learn more about you and your work?
Yeah, thanks, Ben. You can follow me on Instagram, on Twitter and Facebook. Okay. I also have a podcast called the Being Known Podcast that in many respects covers a lot of this stuff. We're actually at our third, wrapping up recording the third season, which is it's an unpacking of the book, in fact. Great. So you can find that on Spotify or iTunes, whatever, you know, wherever you get your podcasts. And then I have resources on my website, KurtThompsonMD.com okay. is a way to do that. I want to say one thing though, before sure. we go, it's not about okay. me. It's about your name. I don't mean your name, Ben.
Okay.
I mean the name of your organization. Yes. I don't know where you got where the word gravity came mm-hmm. from. I don't know about that, but, I just want to say it's a beautiful word. Whenever we're talking about like gravity is something that is about as true as it gets.
Yeah.
Like you can't argue right. with it. You can, but like you never win the right. argument yeah. with gravity. Like there's nothing that we do that does not have to keep gravity in mind, despite the fact that most of the time we're not thinking about it. It is true in the way that the biblical narrative is true, in the way the work you're trying to do is to enable people to live into the true world, into the real world. And I'm making this up as far as what your ideas were about the world, but I just love that your organization is called that. It's just a beautiful thing.
Well, that's great.
So yeah. I'll stop.
Well, yeah. I mean, we started out you feeling encouraged at the beginning of this podcast, and now we feel encouraged. So this has been great.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah. In some ways, it was almost like a little confessional community.
Right on.
It was. Yeah. My heart feels full, friends. Yeah. It does. It really does.
This is why I want to do this every month. So
thank you.
Very good. Right. Thank you. All right.
All right.
Thanks, Kurt.
You bet.
See you, friends.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Our show is produced by Ben Sternke, Matt Tebbe, and Ben Hardman. Aaron Sternke does our mixing and mastering. You can check out his work at aaronsternke.com. If you find our podcast helpful, share it with your friends in person and on social media. And don't forget to rate and review us online, as well as subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can join our Gravity community for free at gravityleadership.com/join. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join. And hey, we'd love to hear from you. Ask a question, make a comment, send us an idea, a recommendation, recipe, whatever. You can email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.
Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.